something is going to happen.
What? What's going to happen?
Something wonderful.
Bust it, check it, watch how we wreck it. Gotta watch your back, cause shiz getting hectic. Catching vibes like Count Basie. What up to Aunt Tracy? In the Waffle House with the biscuits and the gravy. Stack them high, let them fly. Step up, it's do or die. It's the everything rally. Throw some ice cream on your pie. We're talking mid-cap, small-caps, Dow 40 G's. Materials and metals, how about utilities? Home builders, Caterpillar, Disney, and GE. We're in the Magic Kingdom. Shout out to Mickey, Minnie, Donald, and Daffy. Even bank stocks are rocking like JP, Citi, and the BNY. Add a little melon, cause you know why. Fed's turning dovish, rate cuts are on the way, and inflation's supposed to mellow. We might live to see the day when Goldilocks is dancing and profits fall like rain, and the recession never happened, the downturn never came, and this bull just kept on running till it ran out of steam, and higher highs keep coming, you know what I mean. These markets run in cycles from oversold to excess, so we keep it in perspective on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard, and light the candles and ring the bells because stocks are back and the bulls are running again. The S&P 500 is coming off its best weekly performance of the year and snapping a two-week losing streak as the Federal Reserve took a dovish tone at last week's meeting on interest rates. They left those rates unchanged, of course, but the tone, the language, the vibe coming out of Fed Chair Jerome Powell was downright hospitable. The economy is growing faster than the Fed forecast. It now projects 2.1% GDP growth in 2024. Unemployment is still low at 3.9%. Supply is growing across the economy, and that's a sign that companies are confident in continued growth. And inflation, which sits at 3.2% on an annual basis, is still above the Fed's 2% target, but it's coming down, and the Fed is kind of cool with it around here. And those rate cuts a lot of investors are hoping for, they're coming too. Likely three of them this year and several more over the next couple of years.
If the economy evolves as projected, the median participant projects that the appropriate level of the federal funds rate will be 4.6% at the end of this year, 3.9% at the end of 2025, and 3.1% at the end of 2026.
If you don't believe Powell, look at the Fed's dot plot, the most boring yet the most important chart in economics today. Interest rates are going to be between 3 and 4% next year, absent a black swan event. And with corporate profits growing along with the economy, this bull market could have some real legs. The S&P 500 finished the week up 2.3% despite some selling on Friday, while the Dow added 2% and the Nasdaq spiked 2.9%. Pretty solid week, and it happened without the participation of Apple, the biggest stock in the market and the second most widely held stock in the world. It's the subject of a big Department of Justice antitrust investigation that could be as seismic as what Microsoft faced in the 1990s. We're going to get deeper into that a little bit later. But first, our big three for the week. Chocolate. Number one, corporate profits are just one way to look at the health of a company or the entire market, but companies have been pretty good at massaging their earnings every quarter, and most of the time they're usually better than expected, except when things aren't going well. But if you're looking for more evidence of the health of corporate balance sheets, look no further than dividend payouts. They hit an all-time record last year, and they're likely to do that again this year. Corporate dividends globally topped $1.66 trillion last year, with banks making up half of that growth. On a global basis, 86% of publicly traded companies either increase their dividends or maintain them, according to the Janus Henderson Global Dividend Index report. The biggest dividend payers were Microsoft and Apple and ExxonMobil. But banks were paying shareholder dividends for holding their stock through the rough waters of the bank bailouts and seizures by the FDIC and those worries about interest rates. But as it turns out, those high interest rates boosted bank margins, and they paid out a record $220 billion in dividends last year, up 15% from 2022. The mining sector was one of the few sectors to actually cut dividends given lower commodity prices last year, but that's not the case this year, and overall, dividends are expected to rise to a new record high of $1.72 trillion this year. Number two, you want a little more evidence that companies are feeling pretty confident these days? Buybacks are back, baby. Those share repurchase programs that goose earnings and reduce the total share count are back in style in a big way. In the fourth quarter of 2023, according to S&P Dow Jones indices, S&P 500 buybacks topped $219 billion. That's up 18% from the third quarter and up 3.7% from the second quarter. Overall, 2023 was a pretty subdued year for buybacks as companies spent just $795 billion on their own shares. That was down 14% from 2022, which was a bear market. Well, according to Howard Silverblatt, the senior index analyst at S&P Dow Jones indices, more companies bought back their shares and actually spent more to do it in the fourth quarter. But the higher cost of shares reduced the number of shares they received and reduced the impact on the share count reduction. Companies with strong cash flows continued to aggressively buy back their shares, as the top 10 companies accounted for over 54.1% of the buybacks in the fourth quarter of 2023. Remember, companies buy back their shares if they believe the share price is going to go higher and if they have no better use for their cash. The fact that more companies are feeling these feelings tells us that balance sheets are strong, companies want to keep ratcheting up their bottom lines by reducing the share count, and they think their stocks are undervalued. And number three, you. How are you feeling? Well, we just released the latest results from our bi-monthly sentiment survey, and somebody cue Joe Cocker because... Yeah, you're feeling all right. More of you see higher highs ahead for the stock market. 33% expect higher returns over the next 6 months. That's a 12-month high for that. Only 19% expect losses. 46% of you say your portfolios are riskier this year than they were last year. And 10% are investing more in crypto, specifically Bitcoin and Ethereum. That's up 5% from last year. Maybe it's those spot Bitcoin ETFs. 50%, though, think the stock market is overvalued. Where do you see those bubbles? In AI-related stocks, of course. Also in crypto, in megacap tech, in housing and real estate, and in internet and communication stocks. But that's not stopping you from loading your portfolios with these types of stocks. What are you worried about? Well, the 2024 presidential election, that's top of mind, and that's been that way for the past 6 months. Inflation comes in number two. U.S.-China relations, third on the list. War in the Middle East, fourth on the list, and then persistently high interest rates. That's becoming less of a factor in your psyches. What would you do with an extra 10 grand if you had it? Well, most of you would buy individual stocks, stock ETFs, or stock index funds. CDs are way down on the list. Only 8% choosing CDs now. Only 8% would pay down debt, and only 6% would buy a money market fund. And those of you that have a money market fund, half of you say you intend to move that money into stocks in the next 6 months. 19% say you're not likely to do that at all. So let's take a 50,000-foot flyover, and from up here, your enthusiasm makes sense. Net worth is at an all-time high. Stock prices, all-time highs. Housing prices, all-time highs. Economic activity, all-time highs. Air travel, all-time highs. You can earn 5% of your cash in the bank, and there are plenty of jobs out there. Now, not everyone's feeling good about their money and the economy, to be sure, but the shareholder and homeowner class is sitting pretty right now. Count your blessings. Let's get set up for the week ahead, and it's going to be a shortened trading week here in the U.S. in observance of Good Friday, when markets will be closed. Following last week's Fed meeting, we're going to get more data points on inflation and consumer spending this week to bolster the central bank's case that price increases are subsiding and we're going to keep on spending. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Index for March, the Fed's preferred gauge of inflation, that'll be released this Wednesday, followed by reports on consumer confidence and durable goods orders. It's the last week of the first quarter, and what a quarter it's been for investors. The last of last quarter earnings reports are going to be released as widely held companies, including Walgreens, Carnival Cruise Lines, and GameStop, will release their latest results. And then we're going to enter a little quiet period for companies over the next couple of weeks as they prepare to report their first quarter 2024 results. And not to rain on anyone's parade, but investors might want to prepare for some seasonality shifts. According to our pal Jeff Hirsch at the Stock Traders Almanac, April is the final month of the best 6 months of the year for the markets, historically speaking. Don't be surprised to see a little more volatility and a little more sector rotation coming up in April, but that's just markets being markets. And we, my fellow passengers, we are investors for all seasons. The everything rally, except for bonds, of course, has a lot of people scratching their heads and doubting whether this is sustainable. There have already been more than 20 all-time highs for the S&P 500 this year, and we aren't even in April yet. At this pace, the stock market could hit 90 all-time highs this year, crushing the record from 1995, when there were 77 of them. As we know from our good pal Ryan Dietrich at the Carson Group, great years in the stock market, like last year, are usually followed by good years. But this is really, really good so far, and it could be great, even though there seem to be a lot of reasons why this just doesn't feel normal. High interest rates, lingering inflation, geopolitical instability, a U.S. consumer that seems stretched beyond our limits, you know the deal. But what if this is all actually normal and economic and market conditions are pretty darn good? Well, instead of citing Ryan Dietrich and his great stats again like we do in almost every episode, we're bringing him back aboard the Express right where we like him. And here he is, Cincinnati's favorite son and the chief market strategist for the Carson Group. Welcome back to the Express, my friend.
Caleb, thank you for having me. List all those worries. Don't go and turn me bearish now. I didn't realize all those worries are out there.
I call you a realist, and you like looking at real data and real stats. And the S&P 500, as you know, it's up around 10% so far this year, around there, after a 25% rally last year. Why is this perfectly normal?
Yeah, well, boy, it doesn't feel normal, does it? But I mean, listen, there's a lot of ways to look at this. And the one I think you're getting at, I share this a lot. When you're down in a midterm year, like last I checked, Caleb, we were down in a midterm year in 2022, down almost 20% on the S&P. For whatever reason, or actually I have some reasons we get into it, but you tend to see the next year pre-election years, which I know it came with you last year a couple of times, say, listen, be optimistic, the stocks might do well. People hated that call this time a year ago, but obviously it played out. You average like 25% in a pre-election year when you're down in a midterm year. That's right where we were. And then you fast forward to an election year where we are now. Election years have never been down. I think it's higher, like seven or eight of the last times we were down in a midterm year. The election year was higher and really strong return. So to say it's normal, it doesn't feel normal. I totally get it. At the same time, there are a lot of different things that are taking place that really make this fairly normal, even though it doesn't feel normal.
Yeah, I know. A few months ago, a lot of market watchers were lamenting the bad breath in the stock market, given the leadership of NVIDIA, the other chip stocks, Meta was there, a few others. That's not the case anymore, is it? Breath has really improved. Give us a good example of how that's happened across the market.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, listen, last year we heard that, right? Only seven stocks going up. And we pushed against that. There were more than seven stocks going up. Yes, those large companies, their market valuations were so large, they accounted for a lot of the gains. We get that. But you just look at what just happened yesterday, right? Just yesterday, okay? We saw the largest percentage of stocks in the S&P 500 make a 52-week high in 3 years, okay? 3 years. That's a long time. So there are a lot more than just seven stocks going up, or I guess what is like four stocks going up now. We've kicked a few of them out. But we've really liked small and mid caps. And I know you say small caps, everyone gets a certain opinion on this. But small and mid caps quietly are doing well. And in the last 2 months last year, Caleb, Russell 2000 gained like 24%. And then this year's kind of chopped around, yes. But historically, when you gain more than 20%, like we did right in the last 2 months, it's very rare to gain 20% in 2 months for anything, let alone small caps. But historically, take a wild guess. Going out a year, you're up like 27% on average. Oh, and then by the way, you got a Fed that's not as hawkish as it once was. You got an economy. We get into this economy that continues to surprise to the upside in our view. So small mid-cap participation. And one final comment, if you'd have told me or just about anybody else, you know, a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, that Apple would be doing what it's doing, hitting 52-week relative lows, underperforming. Tesla be doing what it's doing. Oh, and by the way, you punted the number of rate cuts and potentially when those cuts are going to happen. If that's all you knew, I would have said, oh boy, I bet we'd be down a little bit. But we're not. We're up 10% for the year on the S&P. It's the lifeblood of a bull market. I know we're fans of J.C. Peretz. J.C. says, you know, lifeblood of a bull market, rotation. Well, we are seeing rotation here from some of those previous leaders into other areas like the industrials, like the cyclicals. You know, the last comment here, go all day. Last comment, the Fed meeting, I think it was the end of January, like January 29th to 30th, whenever they came off a little bit more hawkish, pushing back on all the rate cuts that were being priced in. The top performing group since then has been materials. All right. I mean, that's now maybe it's some of China, maybe not. I don't know. I just know we're seeing cyclical leadership. That's something we expect to see this year. Fortunately, that is playing out.
Yeah, I want to get more into the sector rotation because it is underway in a big way. We do have energy, mining, materials, industrials leading the gains. Tech took a backseat. You mentioned Apple. It used to be as Apple went, so went the market. But now there's other leadership there, not only in tech and consumer discretionary, but across the market. So why is this normal to have that rotation? And why is that a good thing in terms of the trend?
In the late 90s, you know, what was happening? Well, tech went up a lot. The market went up. We understand. But really, at the end of that bull market, it was only tech that was going up. And then there was a weak underpinning and things cracked. And then you think about 2007, what happened? Well, financial started to crack. Some other groups started to crack. Even though new highs were being made, there wasn't much participation. Keep this simple. Like I said, we're seeing a lot of participation now. Now, things are stretched. I mean, this is going to be, you know, one of the greatest 21-week rallies we've ever seen, maybe up 26, 27% on the S&P. That's a very stretched rubber band, let's be clear. But I took a look recently when you're up more than 20% over a 20-week period, which we were as of last week. 1 year later, you ready for this? S&P has been higher 21 out of 22 times. with a 13% average return a year after those massive gains. So just let's be clear, this is an incredible rally since late October. I don't know if I'm answering your question, by the way. I'm just going on another rant here. But since late October, this has been an incredible rally, and that probably suggests, hey, we get some near-term consolidation, perfectly normal. We'd still be bullish, but oh, here's your question. But hey, one final thing here. Look at advanced decline lines. I love looking at advanced decline lines, how many stocks going up versus down. And we've seen advanced decline lines peak for, you know, almost a year or two ahead of major peaks before warning signs. Just this week, the S&P 500 advanced decline line hit an all-time high. The NYSE advanced decline line hit one. The Dow hit one. Mid-caps hit one. The small caps haven't, but I think you're at about a 52-week high as we talk. So there is a lot more participation under the surface here, and that, again, is a healthy sign for a bull market.
Yeah, that's all really good and really strong. And you want that broader participation. Think of it like a basketball team. You want your bench scoring, right? You want good defense. The Fed was very dovish at last week's meeting, Ryan, and pretty transparent. 3 rate cuts this year. A lot of people had that penciled in, but there was a lot of questions. Is it going to be 2? Is it going to be 4? Is it going to be September? The economy is growing faster than the Fed thought it might. But a lot of people thought and fear those impact of those rate cuts that are going to be coming our way, the impact of those. Why are they misguided in terms of what might happen to the market when the Fed starts cutting rates? Because the traditional thinking for some has been, hey, if the Fed's cutting rates, it's not a great sign. But why is it not a bad sign?
Yeah, you hate to say what are the 4 most dangerous words, right? Sir John Templeton, this time is different. But really, you know, this time when they cut, you know, previous times, like you said, the tech bubble, the recession, they cut bad things, right? Financial crisis cut bad things. 100-year pandemic cut bad things. But we did find there are times when we call this more normalized. That was cutting because the economy is slowing and you're in a recession. Maybe, honest to goodness, you don't know at the time and you know after the fact. I'll be very clear. But there were some times in the mid-80s, in the late 80s, in the mid-90s, honestly, in 2019, right, where then the pandemic happened. Yes, you kind of put an asterisk next to that one. But there have been times where they just hiked a lot, and there was, okay, you know, the economy did okay, now we can pull things back a little bit, and that's more of a normalization. And when we've looked, we've seen that that has been usually pretty bullish. And I shared one of these stats on Twitter just recently, and I shared it before, and no one cared. I shared it recently, and it was popular, so I'll say it again to listeners here. I found 20 times using Bloomberg data back to like the 80s. So legit data, I'm pretty sure here. 20 times the Fed cut rates when the S&P was within 2% of an all-time high. So that's the day before the decision or the cut. It was so like at an all-time high, pretty much at an all-time high. It is what it is, Caleb. 1 year later, S&P higher. You ready for this? 20 times. So we've got this scenario where they hiked a lot to slow inflation, to slow the economy. The economy wobbled. We avoided the recession. And now we're on the other side of this with some really, you know, strong growth. I mean, who would have thought a year ago we'd have nominal growth in our country of 5.8%, more than China? I mean, we were bullish. We were one of the few places that said stocks going to do well and there'd be no recession. And we can get into all the reasons why. We didn't think we'd have that much growth, better in China, but we did, right? And that's, I think, something that's so, so very important. Again, the backdrop or the backbone to this whole economy is the consumer. Consumer still looks pretty darn strong to us, and we still don't see any major threats for a recession anytime this year.
Yeah, we're going to get to the consumer in just a second, but corporate earnings, Ryan, better than expected. Surprise, surprise, they're always better than expected, but they were a lot better than expected. Are companies just better at managing their earnings and their margins, or have they found their stride in terms of more productivity and more profitability?
Yeah, I think it's, well, you know what, gee whiz, I think it's a little combo of all those. I think all those things, along with just, you know, the economy that continues to surprise. But you look at earnings, right? We've had this big rally, right, over the last 6-7 weeks. We looked at forward S&P 500 earnings going out 12 months. That's up more than 2% the previous 7 weeks. What in the world does that tell you? That's a pretty darn big move, especially kind of at the end of earnings season. I mean, we're looking at record earnings this year. Okay, it's estimates, we are aware, but we're still seeing positive things coming out. We're looking at record CapEx, right? Companies investing in themselves. That's a really positive thing. Oh, by the way, profit margins, which everybody's been telling us profit margins are only one way to go, and that's lower. They've started to go higher as well. That's kind of a trifecta of really positive things that are out there. And then one other concept that we've talked a lot about, like literally our outlook that we released, you know, a couple months ago when we were so optimistic on the economy and the stock market, was productivity. Our country's not had a lot of productivity for a long time, really the mid to late 90s, last time we saw strong productivity. Productivity the last 3 quarters, Caleb's running at 3.7%. That's really good. Why is that? You know, a couple of reasons. We think one of it is, listen, look at the JOLTS data, right? Quits and layoffs. People are not quitting jobs. They're not getting laid off. Initial claims are consistently around 200,000. I mean, I know some of the headlines in the tech industry making some reshuffles. We get it. But people really are sticking in their jobs. And I've been at my job for like almost 2 years now. It takes a while to learn what you're doing. Back in 2022, and everybody's quitting their job after a couple months, make 10%, go work across the street, It was hard to have strong productivity. Now, as the business cycle is aging, we see more productivity. There's AI coming. I mean, AI is not even really in any of this yet, but it's coming. So we're optimistic that if you history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes, Mark Twain, we all like to use that one. Mid-90s, what would happen? The Fed hiked a lot in 94, economy wobbled. You had Orange County go under in December of 94. Then the economy did okay. And Alan Greenspan, you can Google this, Alan Greenspan productivity talk. He was in front of Congress talking about higher productivity means I can cut interest rates. Markets sniffed that out. What happened when you have higher productivity, though? You can pay higher wages, and the productivity creates a cap on inflation. It's almost like this perfect nirvana, I am aware. At the same time, we all remember the mid to late 90s. So that was a pretty good time, and there are some real similarities with then and right now. These are concepts we've been talking about for a while. A lot of people are catching on to them, but strong productivity is a great thing. We haven't seen it in a long time, and it's the key to this whole thing, in our opinion.
Let's turn to the economy, Ryan. It's not the same as the market, we know, but it's important. The LEI, the leading economic indicators, especially the ones you track at the Carson Group, are finally positive after 2 years. So what are you looking at specifically in your LEI, and what does that tell us about the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, so the Conference Board does an LEI, and that I think it was 2 years in a row where it was negative, right, year over year. And it was like anytime you turn on CNBC, someone's talking about it. Negative LEI, if it goes 4 or 5 months, it's always been a recession. We were promised a recession. We have our own proprietary LEI that's run by Sonu, who just spoke about. And the key is fairly simple. Ours doesn't have as much. They had a lot of manufacturing in theirs. We don't have as much. They had a lot of sentiment surveys and yield curves. We've got more hard data in ours and a little bit less manufacturing, a little bit more consumer, because we think the consumer is what matters. Our LEI, literally for the last year and a half, has been saying pretty strong economy. Okay, so again, there's a little difference there. But now, you know, after 2 years being told that the Conference Board's LEI is this bearish thing, along with the yield curve being inverted. Yield curve, I mean, at least my data, 210 yield curve inverted on April Fool's Day 2 years ago. You can't make that up, April Fool's Day. So we've had a yield curve inverted for a really long time. You got the LEI, and then M2 is another big monster under the bed. A lot of bears been pointing at. Again, we're not ignoring those things, but when we look at the hard data, look at manufacturing, last comment here, look at manufacturing, the sentiment survey, and the PMIs consistently beneath 50. What does that mean? Well, beneath 50 is contraction. That's a purchasing manager's opinion, okay? Then you look at the hard data like industrial production and construction, manufacturing construction and high-tech manufacturing construction. The hard real data, that stuff's been soaring. So it's really this unique situation. I don't even know if it's ever happened in time where people feel one way, they're saying one thing, yet the data and honestly what they're doing, look at retail sales. People don't like inflation, okay, but retail sales continue to be really strong.
All right, let's talk about the consumer because it is 70% of GDP. You mentioned the consumer's pretty strong right now. A lot of people don't feel good about the economy. And if you're not a shareholder or a homeowner, and if you're struggling to make ends meet, given inflation, given other circumstances, you have good reason. But why are consumers better off overall than a lot of people think, generally speaking, Ryan?
Well, yeah, and this is an interesting discussion because clearly people are struggling. I mean, we know that. We know that. But at the same time, net wealth in our country is at an all-time high. Why is that? Well, listen, wages have been pretty darn strong. At the same time, if you owned assets, if you owned a house, you've owned stock the last 10, 15, even more years, your net wealth is probably very strong. And if your net wealth is high, you're going to feel a little bit better about spending things. Now, again, you know, we hear all the time about $1.1 trillion in credit card debt, all-time record. I'm not crazy about all that credit card debt that's out there. But you know what? If you look at credit card debt and disposable income actually grew more than credit card debt last year. That helps finance a lot of that stuff. And to keep this simple, there's a scary chart that went around on Bloomberg shared this chart. But it's like how much people are paying on interest, right? If you own a bunch of debt, how much interest? Well, since the end of 19, overall interest debt is up about $330 billion. That's a lot. That is a lot. Now, not all of that is mortgages. A lot of that is like car loans and credit cards. We get it. But the flip side to higher rates is what? Savers are finally going to get something. If you look what people are making, the interest people are making on their savings, You're going to love this. It's $330 billion. It's like a wash. What people are paying more over here, but the savers are making over here. So there's two sides to every coin. I wrote a blog just today about this, carsongroup.com/research, talking about the idea that I'm not saying higher rates truly helped the economy. What I am saying is it helped pockets of the economy. We're in a market that stocks are going up and you can get 5% on your cash. A lot of people have money in cash getting 5%. That isn't really a bad thing for a lot of people. And I get the problems that are out there. But again, who's really driving the economy? Well, it's a lot of the savers, right? It's a lot of the people that have made more money when it comes to the investments and things like that, the stock market and housing. So that's what moves the economy. As a steward of assets, my job is to just kind of read through the data and give the best opinion I can. And when I see things like that, overall, people are struggling, yes, but the big picture of the consumer is still pretty darn strong, in my opinion, Caleb.
Well, we will link to that blog in the show notes. So much good analysis there. All right. Hot take for the rest of this year. What's nobody talking about that we need to start talking about? Or what do you want people to not talk about because it's actually happening and it could come as a good surprise?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to use a word that I did say already and people have heard this word, but it's mid caps. Everybody talks about large caps. Everybody talks about small caps. Everybody talks about this and that. Mid caps are our largest overweight, the models that we run. I mean, there are some really cheap and good values when you look at mid caps. And like I talked about, if you're going to have this recession, sure, mid caps and small caps probably won't do as well. We don't think we're going to have that. I've already made that clear. And now you've got, you know, the Fed is more dovish. Yes. When those cuts come, hey, we think there's probably still 3 or 4 cuts coming this year, maybe not start until June. But mid caps are an area that we think is wildly underloved. Nobody's talking about it. And that doesn't mean you put 100% of your portfolio in mid caps. I'll be very clear, about 9% or so of the portfolios on average mid caps. We'd have maybe 10 or 11% in mid caps. But we are overweight mid caps and really think that's an area that is underloved. It has a lot of potential for the rest of this year, if not further. We like small caps as well. I mean, but again, mid caps are one I don't think people talk about.
You're right. Nobody talks about them. They're not sexy, but they are big employers and they drive a lot of economic growth in this country. All right. You know, Investopedia is built on our investing terms and our dictionary. We've taken your favorite terms before, but I need to know your favorite investing term right now. What is Ryan Dietrich's favorite investing term?
I'm going to go with M2. Okay, I'm going to go with M2. And here's why. Everybody keeps talking about M2, how all this money supply is up and the money supply is down and it's bullish and it's bearish. I mean, literally a year ago, people were telling me M2 was bearish and now people are telling me M2 is bullish. I don't even understand necessarily what the argument is. Okay, so maybe it's maybe my least favorite term. You know what? Maybe I'm giving you the exact opposite answer you wanted. But M2 is something that is so misunderstood, in my opinion. I think if you look at how much banks are actually lending, right, those things matter more. Look at the credit markets. Look at things that actually show how the economy is functioning or financial institutions are doing. Those things are still working really, really well. So I think it's important to kind of remember there's always these scary things that are out there. And to me, you know, yield curve, M2 and LEIs are three things that I don't like at all. So I give you the exact opposite of what you asked, but I think it's important to kind of know what really moves the markets and what really doesn't. We've seen a lot of people, unfortunately, followed some of these scary things because people with a lot of Twitter followers are sharing charts from 2000. Oh, look at this. It looks just like 2008, right? Getting 100,000 followers by trying to scare people into what's going to happen instead of looking at the facts, right? My podcast, Facts Versus Feelings. Feelings matter, right? I work with advisors and clients every day. We understand that. But facts matter more. And the facts have said to us, and I've been very out there saying this, there was never a recession coming last year. There was going to be a bull market. And we're still in that camp. And fortunately, more people are catching on. But I think it's unfortunate that so many people missed out listening to some of these loudmouths on Twitter that were trying to scare them the whole way up.
Yeah, and to your point, the Fed's balance sheet now at its lowest level since February of 2021, according to our buddy Charlie Bilello there. So we love it. M2 doesn't have to be the one you love the most, but it's your favorite of the moment. And you're one of our favorites, Ryan Dietrich, the chief market strategist at the Carson Group. We will link to his terrific blog. You got to follow him, folks, on X and all the other platforms and the Facts and Feelings podcast you do over there at the Carson Group. So good to have you back aboard the Express, my friend. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Happy March Madness, everybody. Look forward to the next one. Thank you.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. And this week's term comes to us from the Department of Justice. That's right, the top cop on Capitol Hill. And given the DOJ's lawsuit against Apple, our term of the week this week is antitrust. That's right. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland filed a wide-ranging antitrust suit against the iPhone maker last week, accusing it of employing a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers. According to the world's greatest website about all things money, antitrust laws are the broad group of state and federal laws that are designed to make sure businesses are competing fairly. The trust in antitrust refers to a group of businesses that team up or form a monopoly to dictate pricing in a particular market. The Sherman Act, the Federal Trade Commissions Act, and the Clayton Act are the three key laws in antitrust regulation. And in this particular case, the DOJ's allegations range from Apple violating the Sherman Act by using its iPhone to prevent other companies from offering competitive services, like digital wallets, to limiting the functionality of hardware and making it difficult for users to switch to and communicate with competitive devices, such as Android phones. For train lovers like us, the Sherman Act, passed back in 1890, was used to prevent the American Railway Union from monopolizing the nascent railroad industry. Fast forward to the 21st century, and the DOJ and the Federal Trade Commission have been wielding antitrust laws like the Sherman Act against big tech, filing suit against Alphabet, Amazon, Meta, and now Apple for allegedly trying to monopolize the smartphone market. You know how people with Android phones have trouble getting text messages from people with iPhones? Those group texts where there's always someone with an Android or Galaxy that can't follow the chain? So frustrating and potentially illegal now, according to the Attorney General. Here he is at last week's press conference announcing the lawsuit.
In 2022, Apple's CEO was asked whether Apple would fix iPhone to Android messaging. The questioner added, quote, "Not to make it personal, but I can't send my mom certain videos," close quote. Apple CEO responded, "Buy your mom an iPhone."
Thanks for riding with us this week, as always, and special thanks to our pal Ryan Dietrich for climbing back aboard the Express. He always has a first-class seat on this train. We're going to link to his blog and his terrific podcast and all the reports we cited on this week's show in the show notes, and you'll find those wherever you ride the Express. And we'll talk again a little further on down the line.